Crockett versus Commonwealth, Mr. Farashi.
Good morning.
You have 15 minutes. Do you want to reserve any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right, sir. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm Afshin Farashi. I represent Mr. Cameron Crockett on appeal. Mr. Crockett was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in Virginia Circuit Court. We have raised 4 issues on appeal. Three of those issues revolve around whether or not the trial judge erred and denying the motion for a new trial. I'd like to begin with the assignment of error dealing with after-discovered evidence. And this deals with the testimony that was presented at the motion for a new trial hearing and slash sentencing.
The Attorney General says that issue was waived because the trial court never ruled on those statements. Did the trial court do so?
Yeah, well, actually, that had to do with the inconsistent statements witnessed. I will address the issue right now. The trial judge did rule on that issue, Your Honor, and here's how the trial judge ruled on the issue. Trial counsel filed a motion specifying the reasons for a new trial. Trial counsel made those arguments. In response to trial counsel's arguments, the trial judge made some comments indicating that he was going to deny the motion for a new trial. And then most importantly, the court's order says defendant's motion for a new trial is denied. This court has repeatedly stated that trial judges speak through the orders. And this court has gone as far as saying even when that order arguably is inconsistent with what was said in open court, the order controls. And this order very clearly states that defendant's motion for a new trial is denied. And we submit to you when the trial counsel has argued every single motion, every single basis for the motion, and the trial judge's motion is denied, the trial judge has made the ruling. And the focus of the preservation of the issue is not really on the trial judge, it's on the counsel, whether counsel has presented sufficient evidence for the trial judge to make an intelligent ruling. And we submit to you that's what was done in this case.
Then you concede that where the trial judge was ruling on the motion for the new trial on the three bases in which it was presented, when he only mentioned two and nothing further, that it was not brought to the court's attention, nor did any effort be made to get the court to rule that it was addressing the Brady, than generally that none of this was acquired afterwards and met that criterion.
Your Honor is absolutely correct. Trial counsel did not specifically ask for the court to specify exactly what the ruling is on that first basis, which is the failure of the Commonwealth to disclose exculpatory evidence.
The trial court ruled on third-party confession and seatbelt from the bench.
That ruling was explicit, yes, Your Honor. When I say explicit from the bench, exactly. But the trial judge made comments prior to those rulings to defense counsel in response to defense counsel's argument, indicate that trial judge was overruling that motion. And also, as I say, the order states motion overruled. And just to state the obvious, no new trial was ordered. I submit to you that trial counsel had a good faith basis, actual basis, to believe that the trial judge had made a ruling on this issue. That's why the issue was not raised. But I would certainly concede that better practice would be to ask the trial judge for a very specific ruling on every basis, no question about that. But that is not the same thing as saying that the issue has been waived. I want to discuss the issue that there's no question that it was preserved, and that's the testimony of Ms. Elizabeth Wales. Trial counsel presented the testimony of Ms. Wales after the trial at the motion for a new trial, which was also the sentencing hearing. Ms. Wales testified to statements that she had heard by Jacob Palmer, who was the person that the defense contended was the driver of the vehicle that caused the death of the victim in this case. Ms. Wales testified, not vaguely, very clearly, that she heard Jacob Palmer say that he got away with it. He thought he had killed both of them. and that he was going to just live his life like nothing had happened. And that is very significant for many reasons. First, when he says, "I thought I killed both of them," the appellant, Mr. Crockett, and Mr. Cordy, the deceased, were in the car. And looking at the way that crash happened, it's very, to someone standing on the outside looking at the car, it'll be apparent that whoever was in that car was probably dead. So that statement is very significant, that "I thought I killed both of them," as opposed to what? As opposed to having killed only one of them, being the deceased in this case. Second, that statement, as Ms. Wales testified, happened in May of 2011. Why is that significant? Well, May 2011 is where this case, when it was first tried, resulted in a mistrial, a very high-profile case, and that is significant. Now, the Commonwealth...
wasn't she somewhat ambiguous as to the date she overheard this conversation?
Yes.
Initially?
Initially, the court is absolutely correct. She was ambiguous, and that's what it was, ambiguous as far as what was here. But as she explained later, shortly later, during the same testimony, that she got a little confused about school year, calendar year, and then she stated very emphatically that she's positive, 100% positive, that statement was made in May of 2011. And let me make one point about that. Even if the testimony is ambiguous on that point, it still doesn't take away from it being material. It still doesn't take away from it being after discovered evidence, because there's no question that that evidence came to light after the second trial. She testified, Ms. Wells testified.
But to be material, doesn't it have to be likely to have result in a different outcome?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the trial court found that whatever statement was made didn't overcome the physical facts that were found at the scene of the crash.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the test for what is material, what is not. It's a slightly different test than the exculpatory evidence context, but quite frankly, it's a stricter test. But here's why the trial judge was incorrect. First of all, he mischaracterizes, when he says vague, it wasn't vague. That's just the trial judge's characterization of it. That is not the same thing as a trial judge making a finding and a fact. That is not the same thing. He says it was vague. It was not vague. She was very clear what was said, and when it was said, yes, she was a little confused, but it was 2010, 2011, but that doesn't make it vague. And at best, makes it ambiguous, but she was very clear it was 2011. So that characterization is incorrect. Now, why is looking at the broader picture, why was the trial judge incorrect? Well, you know, we have to take that statement and place it in the context of the evidence that was presented in a trial, and then ask ourselves, would the result been different? And here's why that evidence is material.
Well, let me ask you, though, before you finish with characterizing vague as not being part of the fact-finding process, isn't that an evaluation of the credibility of the factual evidence that's been presented, and doesn't that have a big impact on how much weight it would be given?
Your Honor, I think that's a good point, but Judge Lowe did not make a fact-finding regarding the credibility of Ms. Wales. I think she...
Would it have been a fact-finding situation if the judge says, "It's incredible"? That would have been, wouldn't it? If the judge finds the testimony's incredible, isn't that a finding of fact?
It's a finding of fact, but...
Okay, why isn't this a degree of that, a shade of gray, but the same kind of evaluation being done by the fact finder?
Well, because... because it doesn't accurately describe what happened. I mean, just because it's a finding of fact, it doesn't mean that this court accepts it. I understand the court makes a difference, but if the trial judge characterizes certain evidence, and the evidence, when you look at the record, the evidence doesn't support what the trial judge has said, then you disregard the trial judge has said. But I don't think we need to go that far. All we're saying is that the testimony was clear. And And as I was saying, this testimony has to be placed in the context of the trial. Well, what happened at trial? What evidence was presented at trial? Well, the evidence presented at trial was that Jacob Palmer was at this party with Mr. Crockett and the deceased. The evidence presented at trial was that all three of them left the party at some point for about 45 minutes to an hour. There was all the witnesses weren't clear on that, but they were very clear on one point, that all three of them had left the party. Later on, we heard testimony that Mr. Palmer was back at the party, breathing kind of heavily, and asking about Mr. Crockett and Mr. Cordy. Mr. Crockett testified. Now, I understand that that's the defendant's testimony, but we've got to put this evidence in the context of the trial. Mr. Crockett testified that he gave his keys to Mr. Palmer. And this is very significant because Mr. Crockett didn't say that he was sitting in the back seat and saw Mr. Palmer driving. Mr. Crockett was, and I submit to you, that bolsters his credibility. He could not recall the face of the driver of the vehicle. He could have easily testified that was Mr. Palmer, but he did not do so. But he testified he had given Mr. Palmer the keys to the car.
This testimony has to be after discovered evidence also has to be put in the context of the fact that this was a horrific crash, that people were on the scene within seconds of the crash, and there was only one person got out of the car, that was the appellant, and that the appellant subsequently denied there was anybody else in the car, including the victim, although he later came around and admitted to that. Now, all of a sudden, years later, we have this ambiguous, at best, statement, and I'm having a hard time understanding why the trial court erred in saying, look, even if that had been presented, we'd still be where we are today.
If I may address the first point, the three witnesses that the court refers to that said no one else left that vehicle, only Mr. Crockett and Mr. Cordy was in the car. All three of those witnesses at various times during the testimony conceded that there was a lot of dark spots in that area, that there were periods of time that they did not have their eyes on the vehicle, and all three of them had testified that someone could have left that car without them even noticing it. So that was a testimony.
Didn't Mr. Crockett himself at some point say he was the only one in the car?
He did, Your Honor. That statement wasn't at trial. That statement was made to the police that night,
right,
when his BAC is, I think it was 0.14, 0.15, based on the hospital records. And we heard testimony that he had been injured in this horrible crash, no question about that. And you heard testimony from expert witness saying about the kind of damage that could have been done to your comprehension and what you're. So
you're into your rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I like to, if it's okay, I like to sit down and
preserve the rest.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much. Thank you.
Mr. Katz.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. As I understand, counsel has raised but two of the four assignments of error. Specifically, he's addressed the issue of whether the exculpatory evidence Brady claim was preserved and the third-party confession issue. To the extent he's not addressed the other assignments of error, in the interest of preserving my time, I will rely on my brief as to those. With respect to whether the trial judge issued a ruling as to the exculpatory evidence, I would submit if counsel's argument is applied by this court, it would do violence to the principle that there must be some ruling for this court to review.
What if the trial judge just says motion denied and walks off the bench? Hasn't he effectively ruled on all the issues that were presented to him?
It would be reasonable to infer under those circumstances that ruling applies to every issue raised. But here, the record is very different because you have the trial court articulating two of the three and omitting any mention of the third.
What about the court order?
Your Honor, again, we have, as Judge Bumgarner asked, we have the trial court being denied an opportunity to address the third issue that it did not rule on. And so if we were to assume, in the absence of articulating any rationale for doing that, that the order purported to address the third claim, again, denying the motion on that ground required some determination as to the materiality of the purported exculpatory evidence. And there is no record that the court engaged in that analysis. So this court is put in a position, how can it opine on the correctness of reasoning that the trial court did not engage in? I mean, it's undisputed.
Well, trial courts often take the position that the less said, the better. when it comes to appellate review. And I think, you know, I'm sensing that your argument is that we need to tell them, no, you need to make a complete reasoned analysis of the issue before it can be addressed on appellate review.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that characterization of my argument. I think, as Your Honor pointed out, in a circumstance in which the court said nothing to indicate its determination of the issue, where the court simply denies it, I would argue that is vastly different than the facts here, where the court goes out of its way to opine on two of the three issues. And I don't think we can say, in light of that record, well, clearly the third one was meant to be applied in this order. I mean, I think that would be unreasonable in light of the record.
You didn't address the merits of this argument. Do I take it from that if you lose on the procedural issue, you feel that this is in fact error?
No, Your Honor, I would not concede that. I think the record is sufficient to suggest that it would not have produced a different outcome had that matter been presented to the fact finder. There is voluminous testimony at trial, an examination of the witnesses that sought to impeach the testimony regarding the presence or absence of the green light, whether the car slid or spun. This evidence would have not added to that in any appreciable way so as to demonstrate a different outcome at trial. So I would not agree that it was material, but I would submit it as waived for purposes of appellate review. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions the court may have on that basis.
We don't have any other questions.
If I may turn to the issue of the third-party confession, I would suggest respectfully to counsel that he's failed to afford the appropriate deference to the trial court in this instance, who saw the live testimony of Ms. Wales. And he wants to argue on appeal that she was not vague, but respectfully, that was a determination for the trial court to make. And he also argues that she was ambiguous at first and then became emphatic. But I would submit another reading of the record suggests that she's not certain at which point it happened until she is led to that point by counsel on examination. And the trial court had the benefit of hearing that entire line of questioning. And the trial court, having heard it, made a determination that Ms. Wales was simply not credible on that score. And factoring that testimony in with all the other evidence produced, the trial court determined that it was not material. And I would submit this court is not in a position to gainsay the fact finder who had the benefit of hearing that live testimony.
Mr. Katz, supposedly Mrs. Wales overheard Palmer say, "I just got free. I thought I'd killed them both. Who were both?
Well, and again, it depends
on... How many people were in the car? There was one vehicle, right?
That's correct.
So where's the both?
Well, as an initial matter, I would suggest it matters very much when in time this conversation took place, because in the absence of the desired timeline, it could be referring to any number of things, and it would be sheer speculation as to whether it involved...
But my question is, assuming that Palmer was the driver, and assuming that Mr. Crockett was a passenger, is there any evidence that there was another person in the car?
No. In fact, there were great pains taken to suggest that there might have been a third person in the car. And every witness who testified at trial was asked about the darkness of the night, the presence of the woods, and it was suggested perhaps that there could be. But in the absence of this testimony, there is no other evidence to suggest that.
And so the fact that he said, "I thought I killed them both," would that be material?
If one believed...
We don't know that there was another... That presupposes that there were two other people in the car.
I see Your Honor's point. It would not be in the absence of any additional evidence that there was a third person in the car. However, if you accept this testimony at face value, that Palmer puts himself in the car, then there is a scenario by which it could be material. But all of that would require the fact finder who's hearing Wales' testimony to credit it as truthful. And for the reasons I've argued, the fact finder had the opportunity to see that she was not certain as to when this conversation took place. And the facts of what's relayed are vague insofar as the context in which this statement was made to his girlfriend. We have a third person coming upon a conversation in progress, and inferences made about the subject matter of that conversation. And she's unable to flesh out in any greater detail what was said or the circumstances surrounding that statement.
Mr. Katz, let me ask you about the credibility assessment of this after-discovered witness. This was a jury trial, was it not?
was.
So if the after-discovered witness testifies, her credibility is assessed by the jury, whether this conversation even took place at all, correct?
In a scenario in which it is presented at trial, yes. Is that Your Honor? Yes, then the jury would have made that determination.
Does a trial judge serve as a screening agent in assessing the credibility, or is he required to, at least for purposes of after-discovered evidence, accept that testimony as being true?
No, I think consistent with Orndorff 2, Your Honor, I think that is the case that really lays out the jurisprudence as it relates to materiality in the after-discovered evidence context in a motion for new trial. And I think and I can give the court the site, that's 279 Virginia 597. I think it's clear in that context that the trial court has to put itself in the position of the fact finder, and it has to make a credibility determination about the evidence that's presented at whatever hearing takes place and blend that in with the evidence the fact finder heard. And I
could see that argument as to the substance of the testimony, that even if you said what you're saying now, that would not have made a difference. But I'm talking about the believability of the witness in the first instance, whether she's being truthful in saying that she overheard this conversation at all.
I think Orndorff 2 makes absolutely clear that that is the trial court's duty. And I would cite the court to page 605 of the opinion, and specifically the quote, "Because the consideration of a motion for a new trial is committed to the sound discretion of the circuit court, when a proper standard is applied by the circuit court, the appellate court may not substitute its own judgment of the record, but must defer to the circuit court, which had the opportunity to assess the credibility of the witnesses and was in the best position to determine the weight accorded the evidence." I think it's clear from that passage that what is presumed to be going on is that the fact finder in that proceeding is making a credibility determination of the evidence in an effort to weigh the materiality of it. And I can't conceive of how that process would work if it worked any other way. With that, if the court has any questions regarding the remaining assignments of errors, I'd be happy to address them at this point. In the absence of that, I would simply rely on my
questions.
I've got one question again. I want to ask Mr. Froschny about this also. His last assignment of error, the prima facie showing of intent to discriminate because of the striking of two members of a protected class. Gender is also a protected class. And if that argument is correct, would we have to say that if you struck two men or if you struck two women, you would have a prima facie showing of gender discrimination?
We would not, because the mere striking alone is not enough to amount to a prima facie showing, and that is the issue in this case. There must be additional facts and circumstances.
I just wanted to make sure we wouldn't be going down a road where we would have basically eliminated peremptory strikes.
No, absolutely not. And again, you know, I've cited it on brief. I would cite to Johnson v. Commonwealth for that proposition. Excuse me. Perhaps it's Jackson v. Commonwealth. No, it is Johnson. That's 259 Virginia at 674. Here, all we have is the fact that the strikes took place. There's no additional facts or circumstances recited by the defense to put that in the context of an improper exclusion based on race. And he's unable to proffer any support for the strike when the trial court asks. And by the same token, he himself has struck African Americans from the veneer. So if the logic were to apply, the defense itself would have committed the same error that they charged the Commonwealth with. In the absence of additional facts and circumstances, it's simply not a prima facie showing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll rely on my brief. I'd ask the court to affirm.
All right. You have roughly 2.5
minutes. Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Very quickly on that last point,
yes, sir.
Is there any evidence other than the fact that two African-Americans were struck by the Commonwealth?
No, Your Honor. We're just going by the record. And our point on that issue is that the trial judge should have made a finding of prima facie case of discrimination and then shifted the burden to Commonwealth for them to come forward with a neutral explanation, and which, by the way, that burden shifting for the Commonwealth to meet that burden is very easy looking at
so
the case law.
If you struck two men or you struck two women, you'd go to the second.
I don't think so. I mean, I think just when we have two African-American females in this case, we would just submit to you, given the reasons for why we have Batson versus Kentucky, the trial judge has to
I won't beat that horse anymore.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you. First, I want to point out that we're not waiving the other issues we did not point out on our opening argument. I want to make sure we're not considering waive those arguments. But I want to address the issue of the timeline that, that the Commonwealth pointed out. Whether it was 2010, 2011 would add just a little bit of strength to the point that this evidence was material, but not that much. The main point is that, as the court pointed out, that Mr. Palmer said, "I thought I killed both of them." That's what makes it material. Now, obviously, if the timing is 2011, in May of 2011, given that a high-profile case ends in a mistrial, that, that obviously adds to the materiality requirement, but I submit to you it's not crucial. But again, the evidence is clear. That's, that statement was made in 2011. And the important point is that this was after discovered evidence. And we certainly understand that appellate courts, really everyone, doesn't want cases to be tried all over again all the time. Certainly a lot of safeguards have been put in place, a lot of obstacles I've put it, you know, to prevent retrials of cases. But given that disposition, we still have rules allowing for new trials when unique circumstances come forward. And I submit to you, this is a unique circumstance where we have a witness coming forward on a crucial piece of evidence that goes directly to the defense testimony. This is not a case of someone who testified at trial and then taking back that testimony. And this is something that, that this court has seen a lot of times and newly discovered evidence. This is not that situation. This is not a situation where new evidence comes forward which causes the defense to shift their defense. No, this is new evidence that goes directly to the defendant's defense. This is not an evidence that, that causes the defense to say first, well, this was self-defense, and then say, oh, no, I wasn't there. No, this goes directly to the point that the defense raised at trial, that Mr. Crockett was not the driver, that Mr. Palmer was. And we submit to you that if the jury had heard this evidence, the result of this case would have been different.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Before we greet counsel, I note that there are a number of people here in the on the Crockett case. You're more than welcome to stay and listen to the remainder of our docket. But if you choose to leave, I would ask that you do so now so that we won't interrupt the next case. Thank you. And we'll greet counsel.